that we did not expect that particular envoy. It was a man dressed entirely in gray, with a beard like a cliff wall and a patch over one eye, with two ravens riding along on his shoulder. Odin himself. Everyone tried to be cool, but it's difficult not to sit up a bit straighter when Odin joins your party. Sort of like if you're relaxing with your friends and Neil deGrasse Tyson walks up, you suddenly want to talk about science. His arrival changes the subject. Two dark elves flanked him, and one carried Gungnir, Odin's spear.
"I come in peace,"
Odin said right away, his head tilting toward the guard for a moment.
"I gave up my weapon willingly."
Introductions were made all around. When attention fell on me, Odin's remaining eye narrowed, but he said nothing. That was enough to communicate his displeasure with me, however.
"Excellent," Briad said. "Before we begin, can we all agree that saving the world would be better than allowing Loki to torch Midgard and all the Nine Realms to bring Gaia under his and Hel's control?"
Everyone nodded or grunted assent, and Briad beamed.
"Good. That's a strong foundation to build upon. The fact that the leaders are here and we don't need to use go-betweens is also good. Let's proceed."
Hours of grievances and apologies followed, together with arguments and concessions and more than two trips into the trees to relieve bladders filled by hot spiced cocoa. I only mentioned those trips because they were perilous journeys for me, which I hopped at first and then gingerly limped through. At no point did we enter the doors of Svartalfheim. Near the end, I must have dozed off, lulled by the drone of carefully controlled voices, because Briet had to shout me awake.
"Sheahan!"
"That was I."
"We are finished. I need your help unbinding the army."
"Oh, yeah. Hey, yeah. I hope they're not frozen to death. What did I miss?"
"Say your farewells, and I'll tell you on the way."
Odin accompanied us back to the army, and Briet filled me in. The new accord between Asgard and Svartalfheim included trade agreements, remunerations for past trespasses, new diplomatic channels, and also a promise that no dark elves would accept a contract that would harm Granuail, Owen, or me.
"Wow," I said. "That's impressive."
"And they will fight with us and Ragnarok,"
Odin added.
"Which is all I wanted anyway. This exercise served its purpose."
I nearly snarled, but managed to merely grunt in response. Fjallar's death, all those other dwarfs set on fire, was an exercise? Including the crafting of that armor and those axes? That was a long and risky game to play, believing that you could maneuver someone into becoming your ally by threatening to exterminate them first. It wouldn't have happened if Briad and I had not become involved, which then made me wonder if she had been in collusion all along. Perhaps the Morrigan, too. I would not put such scheming past any of them, even though it meant using Fjallar horribly, and resulted in many other deaths besides. Would Fjallar still want to fight as one of the Einherjar, knowing that he'd been manipulated so? Would the Svartalfar wish to maintain their new alliance if they knew Odin had somehow tricked them into it? It was all speculation, but I didn't ask for confirmation from either of them. Briet was my ride home.
Chapter 13. Traveling to Cape Arkona is not as quick as much of my travel, since there are no bound trees on the island. I have to shift to the German mainland and take a ferry out to Rügen. But because Orla has been so patient and such a good hound, we stop at a sausage house and order a sampling of their trade. Bratwurst, Knockwurst, and Weisswurst. Orla is happy to be petted by a couple of older women on the ferry, and obligingly growls at a young man who wishes to use her as an excuse to flirt with me. My weapon, Scowager, can be mistaken for a fancy walking stick, so that to some eyes I look like a hiker instead of a martial artist.
Ach! Control your dog!
He says to me in accented English. My hound is quite controlled. You will notice that she growled instead of bit you. That means you should go away now. He starts to berate me in German, an ugly sneer on his face. I don't need to listen, so I ask Orla to bark and lunge at him, but not bite. He jumps back and leaves us alone after that, although he curses us from what he thinks is a safe distance. I smile and wave him goodbye. The older women return and pet Orla some more. Rügen turns out to be a lovely place, with expansive fields and rolling terrain. Orla and I stretch our legs and run across to the northeastern tip, passing hikers and campers and a shepherd with a small flock of sheep.
Fluffy meat, Orla comments.
The remains of Jaromarsberg rest precariously atop chalk cliffs that crumble into the sea a bit more every year. There are no handy signs telling me which way to go to find Sventovit, so I squat down, close my eyes, and reach out to the elemental of the region, which is associated with the lake plateau of the nearby mainland. It's called Mecklenburg.
Greetings. Harmony. Land is beautiful. I send to the elemental, and he... I don't know why I'm assigning it a gender, but Mecklenburg just feels masculine. Responds with joy.
Greetings, Harmony. Welcome, fierce druid.
I'm not sure how to proceed. I can hardly ask Mecklenburg if he saw a white horse go through here 1,000 years ago. Elementals wouldn't notice what color a horse was. They do tend to notice gods, however, since gods often warp existence around them and bend the rules a bit. Their magic leaves traces, and therefore can be tracked.
Query. Any gods here?
Sometimes. Not now.
Query.
Gods with horse?
Sometimes.
Query.
Near my position?
Below. In ground.
That is perplexing. Why is the horse in the ground? Maybe the horse is dead? Or else there is a space underneath Rügen. I ask Mecklenburg to show me, and through my tattoos, it guides me to a spot a few hundred yards away from Jaromarsberg, in a churned-up field lying fallow for the winter, past a lighthouse. The ground opens up in a square, showing me a flight of stone steps leading down into darkness, and I shake my head from the déjà vu.
Nope, 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 I'm not doing that again, I say aloud.
I didn't need another encounter with a creepy trickster god in a subterranean chamber. Though this is somewhat different from that pit in India, these steps are permanent, and the chamber is already excavated. It's not an abandoned archaeological mystery, but more of a secret underground lair, the entrance to which is disguised by a chunk of nondescript turf.
Query, horse is down there?
Yes,
Mecklenburg says.
Query, which god visits horse?
Earth god. Veles.
Oh. That would explain the location of the horse, at least.
Gratitude. Harmony. We'll return later, I say, and urge Mecklenburg to close up the hole in the ground.
Back to the ferry, Orla, I say. Veles might not be down there now, but I don't want to face him alone if he comes back. We need backup.
Atticus and Oberon?
No, I think they're busy doing something else. We need Pirun. He would know best how to deal with Veles.
I don't remember Pirun.
He's friendly. Atticus told me he likes to play with hounds. Oberon wrestled with him.
Did Oberon win?
They wrestled for fun and succeeded in having plenty of fun, so I think they both won.
Best way to play,
Orla observes. Pirun is not difficult to find in Tir na n'Og. A couple of inquiries at the Fey Court, and I'm told right where to go. He's with Flitish, of course, and I catch both of them partially hammered down by the river.
Granuil,
he says, all jubilant and hairy. He raises a bottle to the sky.
You know what time is it? It's time for vodka!
No, thank you, I say, and notice that the two of them are somewhat disheveled, yet wearing blissful post-coital grins. I thank fortune for not arriving much earlier, or I might have caught them busy with each other. I've come to talk to you about Velis, I explain, and his expression falters.
Velis? The bird Velis, he's dead. All my people's dead now. He's only me and Flidish and Vodka now. Have a Vodka! Here!
He thrusts the bottle at me and I wave it away. No, no, he's not dead. That's what he wants you to think. He's working with Loki. He's the one who let Loki into the Slavic plain.
What? Say this again. No. Explain.
He drops the bottle, and his good cheer evaporates. The shadows underneath his brow darken, but little sparks dance in his eyes. The air begins to crackle and hum. And I realize that I'm not wearing my fulgurite talisman that protects against lightning. All right, but easy with the electricity, okay? I'm not protected, and neither is my hound.
No, easy fix. Here.
He dips into a pouch at his belt and produces two new fulgurites, blessed by him to protect against lightning.
This way, if I lose temper, you'll no get hurt.
Thanks. I wedge one of the fulgurites in Orla's collar and tell her not to scratch at it since it's protection, then hold mine in my hand. Any skin contact will do. Safe from accidental strikes, I tell him what I pieced together with the Polish coven, and that the white horse of Świętowit is hidden underground on the island of Rügen, visited on occasion by Velis. I didn't want to go down there, since I know nothing about him.
It's good you did not go,
he says.
You were the traps there for certain, and snakes.
A few stray fingers of lightning arc around his mane of hair, which is charged and standing out somewhat. His fists are clenched tightly, and I can tell he's barely maintaining his control. Snakes?
You like snakes very much. When I am eagle, I eat snakes very much. You know Velis is sometimes snake?
No. Are you saying you want to eat him?
No, I'm saying we are not friendly.
Ah, that's a relief.
Flidish chuckles at this, and Pirun is distracted by it. The charged air dissipates, and I'm grateful to Flidish for dispelling the tension, even if that was not her intention. Would you like me to show you where this white horse is being kept?
Yes, let us go.
He pats Flidish on the thigh, and she shakes her head.
I cannot go with you, she says. I'm in charge while Breit is away.
She does not appear to be in charge of anything except sprawling on the riverbank, and Pirun guesses what I am thinking.
Breit and Vetekis are in Svartalfheim, he says. Flidish must be emergency person now.
I want to ask why Atticus would go to the land of the Dark Elves, but I refrain. I'll catch up with him later. Then it's you and me, Pirun, I say.
And me,
Orla adds. Always, sweethound, I tell her privately, giving her a scratch behind the ears. We move off a few paces so that Pirun can say his farewells and get his weapon, but Flidish does briefly accompany us to Earth, simply to shuttle Pirun there. I can't bring Pirun with me without another headspace, and I don't know him well enough anyway. When we take the ferry to Rügen this time, nobody wants to pet Orla, despite her being just as adorable as before. I take a wild guess that the scowling thunder god, holding an axe next to us, has reduced our approachability. Pirun wanted to fly at first, but I protested that Orla would not enjoy it. So, I say, tell me what I should expect from Velis, besides snakes. What does he look like? Pirun sniffs, considers, then lifts a single buttock off the bench and farts without a shred of embarrassment. It is his first comment on Velis, perhaps, but then he elaborates.
When he's snake, he's big black snake. When he's man, he's still thin like snake. Tall, long straight black hairs and beard with droopy mustaches. Narrow face with cheekbones standing out. Sometimes he wear hat. No, it's not the right word. What is thing like crown but not crown? You wear in band around head? No top?
Maybe a circlet?
Yes, circlet. This is word I need. He has circlet with ram horns on it. And sometimes he wear this. Make people think horns grow on his head, but it's a lie. He's there to make people think he has many powers.
Well, does he have many powers?
Yes.
Can't blame him for his horny haberdashery, then.
What is haberdashing? I am not knowing this word.
The rest of our ferry ride is pleasantly occupied with the rich history of haberdashers and their profession, and Pirun adds,
"Visit a London haberdasher,"
to his personal bucket list. But our faces set into grim lines once we hit land and lope across Rügen to the spot where Velis has hidden the white horse of Sventovit. I check with Mecklenburg to make sure Velis didn't show up while we were gone, and he says no, the only god nearby is Pirun. The turf parts for us, the staircase beckons, and Pirun goes first, holding his axe out in front of him as he descends, perhaps thinking the axe will trigger any traps first and give him time to avoid them. But that makes little sense to me. If Velis is an earth god, he probably has deadfalls rigged, or some kind of cave-in planned. You don't dodge cave-ins or obliterate them with lightning blasts. Pirun, hold on, don't move.
Okay. I am not moving.
The walls of the staircase are earth and chalk, solid for the moment, but unstable, easily collapsed. I put my palm against the wall to see if it's living earth or cut rock by calling out to the elemental. Query, Mecklenburg, can you sense me here?
Yes.
Please cancel all earth magic on this island except my own bindings.
Yes.
Fierce droid bindings only.
Harmony. No earth god magic here. I realize almost too late that the chambers themselves were probably created by magic and hastily add, but keep shape of chambers.
Harmony.
I give a small, pleased sigh, and Pirun looks up at me, a question in his expression. I just canceled any earth magic on the island except mine, I explain.
You can do this?
Yes, Atticus did it once to Barkus. Certain gods work their miracles through the earth all the time, and the earth allows it, but the wishes of druids always take precedence, since we're actually bound to the earth, and gods are more bound by faith.
So these magical traps will not be working now?
Correct. But if he has strictly mechanical ones, those will still be operational.
I am understanding. We go.
The light wanes to almost total darkness for a stretch, but a source of light grows below as we descend, along with a strange hum. When we reach the bottom of the stairs, we hear a click in the walls, and some dust falls from above, but nothing else happens. I think we just triggered a trap, I say.
And yet we still walk,
Pirun replies.
Is good.
Yes. The chamber at the bottom widens and is lined with shelves filled with glass cages. We can see them because there are eco-bulbs hung from the ceiling, powered by a generator somewhere that must be the source of the humming we hear. And inside those cages are many, many rats. What the hell is going on? Those aren't rigged to break on us, I hope, I say.
No, he's not trap. He's food for the next trap.
What?
Listen. You hear it ahead?
Pirun points to an arched passageway at the other end of the chamber, with a single dim light illuminating it.
Under hum, you hear hissing.
Oh. Yes, you mentioned there would be snakes.
Rats are food for snakes.
How thoughtful of Ellis. Fun fact, snakes are not very tasty, Orla observes, probably because they eat rats. When did you eat a snake? Oberon and I found one in Colorado and tried it. We thought it was sicky. We pad down the corridor toward the sounds of hissing, which is not typically a good survival strategy. After a short distance, the corridor ends abruptly at a wide pit about 30 feet square and perhaps 20 feet deep. The bottom of the pit has helpfully been illuminated, so we can see that the floor is completely covered in writhing snakes. It's much too broad to jump. There appears to be an extendable bridge mechanism on the far side, and on our side is a helpful length of chain dangling from the wall, with an illustration beneath it showing a bridge over the pit. Pierun is about to pull on the chain when I stop him. Whoa, wait! Why would Velis put a pit here and then help us to cross it? Pierun drops his hand.
You are right. He would not do this. He's trap. We pull chain, we go into pit with mini snake.
Exactly. And I bet it's a mechanical trapdoor, too. It won't require magic to work. Pierun considers the space, looks at Orla, then says,
Maybe I make wind and we fly across.
Orla is, of course, the trouble. Pierun and I could shapeshift to winged forms and fly across with ease. I have a better idea, I tell him. Let's make a real bridge we can depend on. I contact Mecklenburg again and ask him to span the pit for us with an earthen bridge 3 feet wide. After a brief wait, it begins to form on either side of the pit until it meets in the middle. Elementals are awesome. Snake pit successfully navigated. Another corridor waits on the other side, bends a bit, and the throbbing of generators becomes much louder. When we reach the end of the corridor, there's a floor-to-ceiling iron gate, easily managed and unlocked, and the reason for the generators becomes obvious. We are at the edge of a large cavern, and there are a ridiculous number of UV lights mounted on the ceiling, shining down on a broad pasture of lush turf. It's the finest underground grazing land I've ever seen. Also, the only underground grazing land I've ever seen. All of it built to house and hide the warhorse of Shventovit, a beautiful white stallion who has spotted us and is prancing around on the far side, shaking his head in agitation and snorting. Wow, I breathe. You don't see something like this every day. It's a lot of trouble for a single horse. But that wouldn't matter to Loki. Knowing the best day to start Ragnarok would be priceless information to him. I wonder if he asks the question daily, weekly, or if he only asks when he thinks something has changed in his favor. Even if he doesn't appear daily, those generators have to be switched out, the snakes have to be fed, and the stone stable over to one side has to be mucked out every so often. We shouldn't linger here. Somebody has to be visiting this place regularly, and I begin thinking defensively in case they visit soon. Pierun, let's get over there to the stable, I say. That horse looks pretty upset, and we need it to calm down if we're going to get it out of here.
How will stables help?
I don't want to set up our operation here, where someone can come in behind us.
What operations?
A quick one, you'll see. We jog over to the stable, the warhorse watching us from the far side of the pasture, and I ask Orla to hide inside the stable.
Why hide?
If someone comes in to mess with us, you'll be our surprise counterattack, I say, though I truly just want her to be safe. And I need you to guard my clothes and my staff. Pretty please? She agrees, and I begin to disrobe. Pierun politely turns his back and says,
I think I understand operations now. You will be speaking horse to horse.
You got it on the first guess. Wait here, please. He nods, and I shapeshift to a chestnut mare, which I must confess is my favorite animal form. Running is so effortless, and I love the feeling of my mane and tail whipping in the wind. Not that there's any wind in this cavern,
just a nervous, twitchy stallion. I figure if I approach him as a horse, he won't feel immediately threatened, and will let me get close enough to make contact and soothe him before he charges at me. He keeps bucking as I grow closer, however. The sudden appearance of another horse is not as calming as I had hoped. He is a smart horse who knows how to count, and there had not been two horses in this cavern until this very moment. He knows something odd is going on.
Gods below, he's magnificent. Milk-white hide and a coal-black mane. I switch my vision to the magical spectrum, examine his turbulent aura, and find the threads of his consciousness. I reach out with my own, bind them together, and send him feelings of peace and harmony, and my unabashed admiration for him. He rears back at first, pawing at the air with his hooves, but when he returns all four legs to the earth, he snorts once and grows still, open to hearing, or feeling, or seeing more. I send him visions of the sky above Rugen, and an invitation to go there with me. He nods his head, and I also feel his great desire to go. He hates it down here. No sky, no other horses. He has been so very lonely. I respond with happiness at his decision to accompany me, and am about to tell him to follow, when movement tears my attention away from him. Someone is coming through the gate that leads to our exit. He is like a stick of charcoal, dressed all in black and topped with a drape of black hair. Only his forehead, cheeks, and nose are pale. All else is darkness. He glances at me and the horse of Shventovit, dismisses us, and then he spies Pirun by the stable. His hands curl into fists, his jaw juts forward, and his teeth are bared in a snarl. Pirun does the same when he sees the man in black, who I suppose must be Velis. It's glaringly obvious that they hate each other. Pirun shouts a challenge at him, and I expect to hear Russian, but it's something older, because these gods are much older than that language. But I do recognize the name Shventovit, and maybe a few others. Pirun is most likely demanding to know where they are. I don't understand anything that Velis says in return. His voice is full of spite, though. He probably told Pirun off in the rudest possible terms. And that looked like the end of diplomacy. What happens next is a bit comical. Pirun lifts his axe and tries to summon lightning, but that's a non-starter underground. Velis spreads his hands to either side, palms up, fingers clutching, as if he's holding an invisible goblet in each, and raises them up in dramatic gesture. When there's no response to this, he blinks and looks down at the grass, bewildered that nothing has happened. No earth magic for him, no thunder for Pirun. I'm thinking they're going to have to duke it out with good old-fashioned fisticuffs, but they surprise me and shapeshift instead. Pirun tosses down his axe and takes wing as the biggest damn eagle I've ever seen, while Velis flops, twitches, stretches, and becomes a horror show serpent, a truly gargantuan snake that could swallow me whole as a horse. Pirun screeches, and the snake hisses, and it makes me shudder. Orla,
I say, my mental voice slightly changed by my animal form.
Don't come out. Stay hidden and guard my stuff. I'll be there in a minute.
Okay, she says.
I recommend to the warhorse that he stay where he is, and then I circle around the edge of the pasture toward the stable. The serpent doesn't care. He only has eyes for Pirun, who's circling above, gaining speed and looking for an opportunity to dive. The snake coils itself to reduce the target area, forcing the eagle to go through the fangs if it wants to get to the body. It bobs and weaves its head, trying not to lose Pirun in the glare of the UV lights, but considering the trouble I'm having keeping track of him, I imagine that it's difficult. When I'm halfway to the stable, Pirun attacks, and it's so fast that I can't track what happened exactly, just that the snake is bleeding and there are some feathers left behind afterward. No clear advantage to either. At the entrance to the stable, I change back to my human shape so that my hooves won't clop loudly on the floor and draw the snake's attention. And as soon as I do, I think maybe I should be drawing the snake's attention to give Pirun a free shot. Putting most of my body behind the stable entrance, I simply peek my head out and shout, Velis! The snake's head swings around and spies me. It rears back, and I scramble away from the door just as the massive head plunges through, breaking the frame with the power of its strike and snapping its jaws closed on air. And then, just as quickly, the head is gone, hissing as Pirun takes advantage of my distraction and attacks from above.
Muranuel, are you okay?
Yes, I'm all right, but I need scavenger. I see it resting next to my folded clothes and snatch it up, casting the binding that will turn me invisible.
I didn't know snakes were allowed to get that big.
Me either. Wait here, please. Sneaking back to the door and peeking around the shattered frame, I realized that while I might be invisible, the snake can still doubtless taste me in the air. It knows I'm around, but its attention is back on the ceiling, keeping track of Pirun once more. There's more blood than there was before. I can see gashes in the snake's flesh where Pirun's talons, or maybe his beak, did some damage. But I figure that with Scavenger and an assist from Gaia, I can deliver some serious punishment and give Pirun one more chance. There's no question in my mind that I'm doing the right thing. Any friend of Loki's is an enemy of mine. So I bound forward, leap up, and spin to increase the force, then bring down Scavenger with every ounce of power I can deliver on top of the serpent's uppermost coil. I hear the spine snap, and the impact travels up my arms, and there will be no graceful landing for me. It takes all I have simply to hang on to my staff. The snake makes a sort of gurgling hiss instead of a cry of pain. Then the light disappears. I'm punched in the gut and the back, and the light returns all before I hit the ground. Once I'm there, flat on my ass, the agony begins. Not from the fall, but from the two huge fangs that punctured my torso when the snake lashed out on instinct. The left half of its mouth caught my left half, bottom fang into my guts, top fang into my back. There was venom in that bite, which hits a second later, burning like acid in my veins and throwing my muscles into convulsions. I gasp and struggle to reach the cool serenity of a headspace where I can focus on directing my healing while the other headspace suffers. Atticus told me it was a survival skill and did all these distracting tests during my training to make sure I could access the serenity while the chaos raged elsewhere. But there is no distraction quite like genuine fiery pain. It demands that you give it your full attention and resists being shut out. So it takes several false starts and 5 to 7 precious seconds before I can create that separation in my mind and let one headspace convulse while the other coolly deals with the internal bleeding and breaking down the toxins. And during those few seconds, while I gasp for air on the ground, my head turns to the left. I see the giant snake head of Velis slam to the ground right in front of me, and directly below its jaws, at the top of what could be considered one enormous neck, are a pair of eagle talons. Pirun got him because of me, which, honestly, helps me slip into the headspace I need. I can't talk, since everything is either pain or the healing of it, and that worries Orla something awful, because she's suddenly there and licking my face and trying to say things that I can't spare the concentration to answer if I want to live. I really shouldn't be picking fights with any more gods. I managed to do some serious damage to Loki recently, but only because conditions were perfect. He'd been overconfident and attacked me where I had placed wards against his fire. If he had caught me anywhere outside the fire wards, or if he had brought any other weapons, like Fuilta, the whirling blade he'd stolen from me, or the lost arrows of Vayu, he might have ended me. His simple failure to respect me as an adversary made him vulnerable, and he wouldn't make the same mistake again. It strikes me that the holes in my body and the poison in my blood are a result of the same kind of arrogance. My druidic powers, while impressive, do not truly put me in the same weight class as gods. And neither do Atticus's. He finds a weakness, surprises them, and gets help. Going toe-to-toe will not work. Had Velis not been distracted by Pirun, I don't think I ever would have gotten close to harming him, even with invisibility. And had Pirun not finished Velis off, I surely would not have this slim opportunity to heal. He would have struck again, and maybe even swallowed me whole. The venom of Velis is a nasty combination of fasciculin and a cardiotoxin. The latter is easiest to take care of, As the toxin tries to bond to the muscle of my heart tissue, I can break it down before it depolarizes the cells and prevents contraction. The fasciculin is much worse. It's causing involuntary contractions throughout my entire body, leading to painful spasms and twitching. During my apprenticeship, Atticus gave me extensive training in poisons and their chemistry, including snake venom, so that I would know where to focus my attention when and if I found myself poisoned. The fasciculin attacks a certain kind of neuron that uses acetylcholine as a transmitter of signals. It annihilates acetylcholine esterase, which functionally tells muscles to stop contracting, thereby causing those involuntary contractions. Can't fight back when your muscles won't obey you. It also causes more agony than you'd think something like that should. To combat it and restore voluntary function, I have to not only break down the toxin, but rebuild acetylcholine esterase. And beyond the venom, there's the matter of two rather large puncture wounds with significant tissue damage and bleeding. In my quiet headspace, I work on my body chemistry to save my life, while in the loud, painful arena of my other headspace, I notice that Pirun, as an eagle, really does eat snakes. His beak plunges repeatedly into the neck of Velis and rips out chunks of flesh and viscera, making sure that his old enemy bleeds out. He spits out some of the chunks, but swallows others. The large coil of the snake doesn't move at all past the point where I broke the spine. Only the top third twitches and struggles in vain to win free. It is chilling to watch the death of a god in real time at the hands, or rather, the talons and beak of another god. The eagle is not unscathed, I notice. There are chunks of feathers missing, bare patches in its plumage. It has been bitten, or at least scratched by those fangs, but curiously is not suffering the same effects of the toxin that I am. Perhaps Pirun is immune. The great serpent's eyes go dull, and the twitching ceases, while I continue to struggle on to survive. Pirun steps off the snake and watches it for a full minute to make sure that it really is dead. Then he shifts back to his human form, summons his axe to his hand, and hacks away at the neck until it's severed completely, cementing the death of Velis. Only then does he look up and notice my critical condition.
"Granuel,"
he says, crossing to me and kneeling by my side, taking in my spasms and the hole underneath my ribs.
"Oh no, he's not good, but fight this. Do not die. I am owing you much. You helped me defeat Velis."
He stretches out fingers toward the hole in my gut, and then shrinks back.
"I am not healing, God. Cannot help you, but am wishing I could."
I cannot help him either, though he appears not to notice his bleeding puncture wounds, now clearly visible on his human form. I envy his immunity to the venom. My limbs still shudder with involuntary spasms, but I'm slowly turning the tide, and some of the violence, some of the pain, is receding. Knowing that it will at least not get any worse, I spare a few minutes to deal with internal bleeding. Pirun adjusts himself so that he's in a lotus position, rather than kneeling, and mutters something about healing with me. He closes his eyes, and I do the same. It's helpful, I find. Less incoming stimulus equals more attention that I can devote to righting the ship. And I spare a thought for Orla, who's still very worried. "I'm not okay, but I am healing, sweet hound. Need all my faculties for that. Please be patient with me."
"Okay, I will guard you. Love, Granuel." "Love you too."
Time slips by after that, and I slowly improve. Until my eyes snap open at a thought.
"Loki's mark!"
I croak, and then cough at the effort of speaking aloud. The coughs send spears of lightning through my torso.
"What? Loki?"
Pirun says, and then, more alarmed,
"Where?"
I pause to catch my breath, and then say in a soft voice,
"Velis probably has Loki's mark on him somewhere. A circular brand of runes hides him from the sight of all but Loki. So Loki probably knows Velis is dead. He might come to investigate."
Pirun's eyes go wide.
is very bad news.
And I bet the horse of Svantovit will have the same mark on him. When we move him, Loki will know. Can you check?
Yes, I can do this.
Pirun unfolds himself from the ground and disappears from my sight for a while. My limbs are not shaking as much anymore, and I'm making progress against the toxin. Mecklenburg is helping me quite a bit, giving me his energy, and I thank him for his help.
Gratitude for your strength, I send to him in my Latin headspace.
Harmony, Mecklenburg says. Fierce druid must be well.
And it's then that the uncertainty and fear fall away, and I know I will be well, eventually. And it's also at that moment that I appreciate the time it took me to get to this place. Had I not trained in languages and cultivated different headspaces over those 12 long years, I most certainly would have succumbed to the poison. Binding to the earth is useless without the knowledge and training to use it properly. When you're dealing with years 2 through 10, you think, holy hells, this is a slog. I certainly thought that on more than one occasion. Those ancient druids knew how to train and discipline a mind. All of that training was saving my life now. Pirun returns to inform me that the horse indeed has a small round brand on his flank.
We should be leaving, he says.
I can't move yet, I tell him, and then explain that while prudence dictates that we should worry somewhat, we may have no cause. Loki is no more a god of healing than Pirun is, and I wounded him severely when last we met not long ago.
When can you be moving?
Pirun asks. Soon, I hope. I don't want to stay here any longer than necessary.
What if I carry you out?
I blink. That possibility had not occurred to me. Pirun would certainly have no trouble slinging me over his shoulder like a sack of potatoes, but I might suffer additional injury if he did so, and I'd be cut off from the earth. Maybe let me lean on you and get dragged out upright? I need to keep my right heel in contact with the earth.
Yes, we do this.
But the horse...
Pirun looks across the pasture at the horse, which has now pressed itself against the far wall, hoping to remain unnoticed.
Oh, yes. We need horse, but he's afraid.
Drag me a bit closer, I ask. I can talk to it, after a fashion.
With many grunts and sharp gasps on my part, I'm lifted to my feet and manage a half-walk, half-shamble, with Pirun's help, toward the white horse of Svantovit. My occasional twitches and convulsions make the progress difficult, and emphasize that we are both, as a result of our shape-shifting, very nude. We'll have to remember to get dressed before going upstairs. I keep trying to reach out with my consciousness to the horse until we finally make contact.
Hello,
I tell him. Or, anyway, I send him greetings. I hope my words translate into meaning in his mind somehow. He may not yet be at that level of understanding, but my patience at this point is strained, since I have so much else to worry about.
I am the chestnut mare. Human now. I take both forms. Are you ready to greet the sky once more?
The stallion tosses his head and snorts. Not really a yes. He's still spooked. He will need some convincing, and there won't be a way to hurry through that. I sigh and force myself to take the time to do it right.
I am Granuaile. Do you have a name?
His reply is that, long ago, some humans used to call him Miwash.
Miwash, I would like to take you to a group of women who will protect you from the god who branded you.
The thought of the god who branded him upsets Miwash quite a bit. He whinnies, rears up, and then bucks around.
Let us go together. We will run there under the sky. There will be apples and oats.
Apples appear to be a pleasant thought, and he settles down. I get a question from him next, and an image of a grotesque, four-headed man that I can only assume must be Svantovit.
No, Svantovit won't be there. We are looking for him, too. We would like to reunite you. Do you know where we might find him?
Miwash has no idea, but he walks toward us, and I feel or sense the moment when he recognizes Pirun as a friend of Sventovit. That reassures him, and he's ready to leave with us. I'm not positive that the Sisters of the Three Auroras would be able to withstand a concerted effort by Loki to take Miwash back, but I do know that they won't make it easy for him, and could quite possibly bring him under their power again. Getting the horse there while Loki is still wounded, and while I'm still wounded, will be the trick. We return to the stable area and get dressed. I have to lean against the wall to put on my jeans. I'm not yet steady enough on one leg to manage it without support. Pulling on my shirt is excruciating, considering the wounds in my back and gut. The skin, ragged and oozing blood, is at least closed up at the dermis level, and the internal bleeding is all right for now. But the tissue damage will take much longer to deal with. Orla volunteers to carry Skawaja in her mouth until we're up top, and I thank her. I try walking by myself to the exit, but it's slow, erratic progress, since I'm never sure when my legs will obey me or decide to contract or extend on their own. I fall down twice, which is not fun. But I'm so relieved that I can walk at all that I insist on struggling the whole way to the bridge. There I ask Pirun if I can hitch a ride on his back until we get to the other side. I don't trust my legs enough to risk them over a snake pit. As we walk away on the other side, I ask Mecklenburg to raise the floor of the pit so that it functionally ceases to exist as a pit, and the snakes will have a chance to get out. Likewise, we open all the rat cages as we leave, allowing them to escape, or not, as they wish. Pirun gives me another piggyback ride up the stairs so that I don't tumble down them. And when we're finally out of there and standing on the turf of Rugen under the afternoon sun, we all smile. Or at least Miwash and Orla demonstrate the equivalent of happiness by prancing around. We walk to the ferry, and by the end of that walk I'm feeling confident with my muscle control. The toxin's been nullified, and I have my motor control back. I still have plenty of work to do on my torso, but at least it's not preventing me from being mobile. I charge up the silver reservoir of Skawaja to continue healing during the ferry ride, and we get some looks boarding with a horse and hound, or maybe it's concern over my bloody shirt, but no one gives us any trouble. The sun is almost set when we reach the mainland, and a figure separates from the shadows. Despite the chill, he's bare-chested, which draws plenty of stares. The fact that he's in phenomenal shape and has a wide golden belt supporting bright red pants of a flowing material probably has something to do with it, too. Or maybe it's the huge club-like weapon he has slung over his shoulder. His skin is a dark, rich brown, and his hair is cut close against his skull, as if perhaps he had shaved it a couple of weeks ago and hadn't kept up with it. Everyone's looking at him, but he's looking right back at us as we disembark.
"Pirun," he says, nodding once to him. "And you must be Granuel."
His voice is a thrumming bass, and I can't place his accent, but I love it. "I'm sorry, have we met before? I think I would remember." Brilliant teeth flash at me.
"We have not met. If you were to ask Odin, he would say I am here at his request. But in truth, I do not care what Odin wants. I am here because I wish to meet you. I am Shango."
"Shango? The Orisha? God of Thunder?" Lightning dances in his eyes, just as it does in Pirun's every so often, and he nods at me with a tight grin.
"The very same."
"Why did you want to meet me?"
"I have heard you delivered a long overdue beating to Loki. I would like to hear the story from your own lips. And Odin tells me that this horse is rather important to Loki. You have some distance to travel to his new home, and there's a chance that Loki might show up along the way. I hope you will allow me to accompany you. If Pirun and I are both with you, it may serve as a deterrent, and failing that, I would be honored to fight him by your side."
Oh, damn. I really like to listen to him talk. I want to take him to dinner and just have him read the menu to me. And he's so polite. "I see.
And why did Odin ask you to meet me?
He does not want Loki to have this horse any more than you do.
His name is Miwash, and this is my hound, Orla.
He makes eye contact with both and greets them properly, calling them by name. Lots of people would not pay them that respect, and he rises another couple of notches in my regard. I'd be delighted for you to join us, I tell him, though I hope to hear more about you as well.
We will be running all through the night, yes? Plenty of time.
It'll be my second run across Poland, although we'll be crossing the northern half and from west to east rather than east to west, but at least it won't lack for sterling conversation. And every step will get me closer to the time when I can address the real reason I became a druid. My stepfather has lurked in my mind like dishes left over from a dinner no one enjoyed and no one wants to clear away. A divination cloak will finally allow me to attend to that chore in privacy. I think it's long past time I cleaned house.
Chapter 14. When Briett and I returned to the Fey Court in Tir na n'Og, she looking regal, and I looking every bit as injured as I was, we had a surprise delegation of yeomen waiting for us. It was a large one, 100 or more. They're creepy things, as one might expect from creatures spawned by the Morrigan, and devoid of any sense of humor, or indeed most human emotions, except for greed and bloodlust. They were highly effective mercenaries against the vampires. They had no blood to suck, and could not be charmed, and bullets that might be fired at them by thralls were mere annoyances. They were perfect vampire hunters, actually, except for the high price tag on their services. They had come to inform me that I had overdue bills to pay. The human didn't have any vocal cords, however, so they had to communicate via a spokesfairy. They must have written down in advance what they wished to say, or used sign language, or played charades, I really didn't know.
We have staked and beheaded many vampires for you, druid,
their spokesfairy said in answer to my greeting. Her high, reedy voice, similar to a hamster on helium, didn't match the grim visages of the human.
And at first you paid through Gavnu, but now Gavnu is dead. We have not been paid the bounty on 683 vampires. We will not kill any more until you pay in full.
About that. The vampires have managed to degrade my ability to pay? The fairy repeated.
We will not kill any more until you pay in full.
She must have exhausted her scripted speeches.
Got it. I gave him a thumbs up. I'll work on that. When I have the money, who should I contact?
Me,
Briett said, injecting herself into the conversation.
You will pay me,
she looked at the human.
I will be his guarantor. I expect that will be acceptable.
Briett, you don't need to do that. I haven't asked.
I am volunteering freely and expecting no favors in return, Sheehan. It's done.
I nodded acknowledgement, realizing that I'd have to find myself a lucrative job very soon.
I'd never been much of a get-rich-quick sort of guy. A long life had allowed me the luxury of getting rich slowly through investments. I could raid the store of rare books I had buried years ago by the Salt River in Arizona as a temporary solution. Auction off a few of those, and I could live comfortably for a while, and maybe pay down a fraction of the debt I owed them. But even if I sold everything, a troublesome prospect, since some of them were genuinely dangerous tomes, I doubted I'd be able to pay their bill in full. Since lingering would only expose me to the stares of unpaid mercenaries, I took my leave and shifted back to Flagstaff, outside Sam and Ty's house, wondering how I could possibly keep the war going in the short term. The Hammers of God were a welcome addition to the cause, but not nearly as efficient as the human. They would not be able to ignore the bullets of thralls, for example, who protected older vampires during the daytime. And the vampires could replenish their numbers faster than we could slay them by turning new victims. Without a much greater advantage, it would be a war of attrition that we had little hope of winning. Oberon was stretched out in the grass near the house and saw me shift in. He bounded over to see me, excited to share some news.
Well, guess what? I heard Sam and Ty talking about the citrus air freshener Hal keeps in his car, and they think it's stinky, too.
Sweet vindication, eh? I said, petting him on the neck.
Yeah. Hey, your face looks like you're trapped at an emo concert. What's wrong?
Oberon asked. It's a math problem, I replied, leaving out the exhaustion and the beating I'd suffered.
Oh, I can't help with that. If you need something peed on, though, or a cat's day ruined, I'm your hound. Or maybe you have a sausage on you that you'd like to get rid of?
No, sorry. I'm worried that there's no solution to the vampire problem. There are many more of them than there are of us. Thousands more.
Thousands is more than millions, right?
No, it's the other way around.
Well, are they all mad at you? Or is it just the one guy you told me about? Theo Philip?
You mean Theophilus?
That's the one. It's just him who's really after you, right? But the other vampires all do what he says. So what if you challenge him to a duel, like Julie Daubigny would? Then when you defeat him, you can tell all the other vampires to drop dead.
That's actually a good point. I hadn't heard of any specific vampires who wished to end the druids other than Theophilus. If I could eliminate him, which was the endgame anyway, perhaps the rest of the vampires would redirect their attention to internal power struggles and leave the world's three druids alone.
Of course it is. We don't have to walk into Mordor. We can hop on the eagles and fly directly to Mount Doom.
The question is how I get to the eagles, or rather, take the obvious shortcut you're implying. I don't even know where he is. And since he's technically dead, I can't target him with divination. I know he must be moving around, and I figured he'd eventually come after me in person when he felt threatened enough. I was hoping the human would either get lucky or goad him into the open, but well, that's not going to happen now.
Well, who might know where to find him?
Maybe Leif does. I need a phone. Hal had given me Leif's number, but I had entered it into my phone in Toronto rather than memorize it, and that phone was still there, left behind when Owen kidnapped me from my hospital bed. I could call Hal again, however. Come on, Oberon, let's go inside. Your advice was worthy of a snack.
Yes. You know, Atticus, I've been thinking that I should have a surname, and now that you bring it up, I think Snackworthy would be an honorable family name for a hound. What do you think?
Oberon Snackworthy, eh?
It sounds noble, doesn't it?
When I didn't answer right away, he said,
What? Is it too much?
I knocked on the door before entering and shouted a greeting into the house, announcing myself.
Yeah, come on in,
a voice called, and Ty appeared shortly afterward. He was about to cook up a lunch of bison burgers, so that would serve instead of a snack for Oberon, and he loaned me his phone so that I could call Hal. But in looking through his contacts under H, I saw Helgerson there. Ty, you know Leif Helgerson?
Yeah, not well. More like acquaintances. He was the vampire boss of Arizona, so he knew all the pack leaders and seconds. As a courtesy, he'd call to inform us when he was moving through our territory.
Is this number for him current?
Should be. Updated it when Hal was here and you called.
Fantastic. The burgers were already in the pan and frying up by the time I got a call placed to my former attorney. He picked up on the second ring, which told me he was probably in the other hemisphere at the moment, where it was nighttime. His dry, cultured voice sounded amused.
Hello, Ty,
he said, responding to the caller ID on his phone.
This isn't Ty. It's Atticus.
Oh,
My favorite druid. What a pleasure to hear from you.
I was in no mood to exchange pleasant banter with him, and could no longer conceive of a time when I would be. Where are you now, Leaf?
Why do you ask? Is it time to relieve me of the burden of undeath?
Not yet. More interested in whether you're with Theophilus.
Oh.
No, I am cast out now. A Lucifer in the veritable heaven of vampirism. Excessive pride led to the original.